Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 889. Intercept this compendium on Citizen Omidyar. This is being recorded on February 11th of the year 2016. In our last program, we did a compendium about someone whom I have termed Citizen Greenwald. That is, of course, a reference to Glenn Greenwald, who was Edward Snowden's leaking journalist of choice, and who, in fact, is the exact opposite of what he has been represented as being. He is quite literally a shiller for killers, as I discussed in our last program. I have spoken about Glenn Greenwald, or Citizen Greenwald, as I call him, in many programs. However, because the information was presented in a number of different programs over a 2 to 3 year period, I thought that it might be useful for the understanding of many listeners to gather that together and to compile an amalgam of some of the key documentation about the altogether shocking and frankly disgusting activities of Glenn Greenwald, so that the confusion that I think is only natural for many listeners to experience, perhaps younger listeners in particular, with the media going overboard and presenting Snowden, Greenwald, WikiLeaks, etc., as a bunch of heroes, and then coming in and saying, well, actually, they're really not that at all. That certainly is going to be a difficult glass, or a rather tall glass, to drink at one sitting. As Hitler said, and I'm telescoping and paraphrasing slightly, in Mein Kampf, he said, most people tell little lies. They would be ashamed to tell big ones. They would never credit others with such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts. All good, even explanations, would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, as any trifling detail would dispose them to accept the thing as true. All good liars know this, therefore, and stop at nothing to achieve this end. And as facile a concept as the big lie might be in to many people, you know, you talk about the big lie and people go, oh yeah, right, yeah, groove, the big lie. In fact, it is not an easy thing for people to adjust to in the cold light of day. And with regard to the Greenwald, Snowden, WikiLeaks, and that whole milieu, they are in fact the opposite of what they have been represented as being. And what we're going to do in this program is to pull the camera back, to dolly the camera back, so to speak, and to take a look at the reality of Pierre Omidyar, the kingpin behind eBay. It is Pierre Omidyar who has financed First Look Media and its signature blog or online publication, The Intercept. That is what the title of the program alludes to, Intercept This. And I'm going to gather together information that I have presented over a number of different programs for exactly the same reason that I did this with Glenn Greenwald, or Citizen Greenwald, as I have termed him. The reality behind Pierre Omidyar is fundamentally different from the political reality that most people have perceived as underlying the actions of Greenwald, Snowden, et al. And it is Pierre Omidyar who has financed the latest journalistic adventures of Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras and others. And as is the case with Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden, Mr. Let's get rid of Social Security and bring back the gold standard, Mr. The elderly wouldn't be effing helpless if you'd stop sending them effing checks so they can sit on their A-blank-blank and lay in hospitals all day. A verbatim quote from Edward Snowden in 2009 while he was working for the CIA, the very time at which we are supposed to assume that the angel of mercy alighted on his shoulder and infused him with the spirit of goodwill and beneficence towards his fellow human beings, at which point he sallied forth resolute with the desire to stop at no sacrifice on behalf of his fellow human beings. You know, right. As we take a look at who has been providing the financial slash journalistic platform for Glenn Greenwald and for Laura Poitras, and by extension, Edward Snowden and perhaps Julian Assange as well, because WikiLeaks and the Snowden operation are part of the same mega operation, what I have termed the Conga Line Ops, and the crisis in Ukraine and what is now going on in the Middle East, something that increasingly is threatening to result in a third world war. They are part of what I have termed the Conga Line Ops or the Earth Island Boogie. And Pierre Omidyar is at the very epicenter of these events and is, in fact, the exact opposite of what he has been represented as being. He is no crusader for truth, freedom in the American way, etc., etc. In fact, he is not only someone who has, in many of his most prominent adventures, collaborated with cutouts for U.S. intelligence, such as USAID, or Agency for International Development, the National Endowment for Democracy, the Ford Foundation. He has been deeply involved with covert operations, such as the Maidan coup, and has, in fact, been using his microfinance third world philanthropic programs to help to implement a neoliberal agenda. What we are going to be looking at in our compendium on Citizen Omidyar is Omidyar's synthesis of, quote, philanthropy, unquote, which is his ideological template or mentor for his philanthropic work, is the neoliberal Austrian school agenda of Hernando de Soto, who is someone who has been praised by people such as the Koch brothers and others. And in his microfinance programs that have been implemented in the third world, Pierre Omidyar has been introducing or further developing a neoliberal free market or corporatist agenda in those parts of the world. We are going to be taking a look at the cooperation between Pierre Omidyar's philanthropic efforts in India and an organization called the Rural Development Institute, or RDI, renamed Landesa, L-A-N-D-E-S, as in Sam A. That was founded by a guy named Roy Prosterman, P-R-O-S-T-E-R-M-A-N, and his RDI was a central feature in the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Something younger listeners may not be familiar with, that was a brutal counterinsurgency program in Vietnam in which thousands of people were assassinated by both South Vietnamese and CIA and Special Forces death squads. They were dubbed Viet Cong sympathizers. The reality is that they were just about anybody who was deemed to be in the way, whether or not they sympathized with the Viet Cong. Just go to the internet and look up the Phoenix program, and the younger listeners or newer listeners will be able to fill themselves in on just what sort of, quote, philanthropy, unquote, Roy Prosterman has been implementing through the Rural Development Institute. And we're going to be taking a look, too, at how Pierre Omidyar's philanthropic efforts, again, built on the ideological template of Hernando de Soto and the Austrian school and neoliberalism or free market slash corporatist economics, how those philanthropic microfinance operations and the operations of U.S. intel cutouts, such as RDI, the U.S. Agency for International Development, Ford Foundation, and in particular the National Endowment for Democracy, have been used for coups that the U.S. And other elements of Western intel have been involved in. And last but most assuredly not least, we're going to be taking a look and how those coups have resulted in the ascension of fascist regimes in parts of the world, in particular in India and in Ukraine. So again, what we're looking at is a synthesis between neoliberal economics, third world microfinance, quote, philanthropy, covert operations, and the elevation of fascist elements. And that is what we're looking at. And again, this is by way of dollying out and taking a look at just what is the political reality of Pierre Omidyar or Citizen Omidyar, Glenn Greenwald's journalistic and financial angel. There is far too much information about Edward Snowden that has been downloaded to do a single compendium about Snowden. I've done an awful lot of work on the man I alternately term Eddie the Friendly Spook, the Peach Fuzz Fascist, because he is just that, and the obverse Oswald, because just as Lee Harvey Oswald was the front for a covert operation and infiltrated into the Soviet Union and set up to look like he was infiltrating Cuba, only to have him fingered as the patsy, the would-be supposed assassin of JFK, and then killed before he could defend himself. Snowden, too, has been used as the front for a massive operation, and instead of being portrayed as a villain slash assassin, he has been portrayed as a hero. I think between the two, the evidence suggests very strongly that Lee Harvey Oswald was by far and away the more moral individual. You might want to read a book that I've used in some recent programs and posts. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James Douglas. It is one of the better books written about the JFK assassination. But again, we'll talk some more about Snowden in our next program, but there is far too much information about Eddie the Friendly Spook to download into a compendium. But in order, again, to enhance our understanding, we're going to take a look at Pierre Omidyar, or Citizen Omidyar, who is the journalistic financial angel for Citizen Greenwald, the Shiller for Killers.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
We're going to begin by excerpting an article. Once again, front and center in our work is the landmark journalistic efforts of Mark Ames, and also some collaborative work with Yasha Levine. Ames used to write for NSFW Corp, now writes for the Pando Daily, and is doing some of the finest journalism on the face of the earth, someone who has not received the credit he is due, but he is going to get it right here. In an article called The Extraordinary Pierre Omidyar by Mark Ames and Yasha Levine, L-E-V-I-N-E, published in the NSFW Corp, that's Nancy South Frederick William Corp, of November 15th of 2015, we read the following about Citizen Omidyar's financial, philanthropic efforts, I should say, in the third world. Skipping down in that article, an examination of the ideas behind the Omidyar Network, that's Omidyar's financial, philanthropic organization, again, beginning again, an examination of the ideas behind the Omidyar Network and the investments it has made suggests that its founder is anything but a different, unquote, sort of billionaire. Instead, what emerges is almost a caricature of neoliberal ideology, complete with the trail of destruction that that causes when that ideology is put into practice. The generous support of the Omidyar Network goes toward, quote, fighting poverty, unquote, through micro-lending, reducing third-world illiteracy rates by privatizing education, and protecting human rights by expanding property titles, or, quote, private property rights, unquote, into slums and villages across the developing world. In many regions, Omidyar Network investments have helped fund programs that create worsening conditions for the world's underclass, widening inequalities, enhancing exploitation, pushing millions of people into crippling debt, and supporting anti-poverty programs that in some cases resulted in mass suicide by the rural poor. In 2012, it emerged that while the SKS IPO, an Omidyar philanthropic vehicle, was making millions for its wealthy investors, hundreds of heavily indebted residents of India's Andhra Pradesh state were driven to despair and suicide by the company's cruel and aggressive debt collection practices. The rash of suicides soared right at the peak of a large micro-lending bubble in Andhra Pradesh, in which many of the poor were taking out multiple micro-loans to cover previous loans that they could no longer pay. It was subprime lending fraud taken to the poorest regions of the world, stripping them of what little they had to live on. It got to the point where the chief minister of Andhra Pradesh publicly appealed to the state's youth and young women not to commit suicide, telling them, quote, your lives are valuable, unquote. The Associated Press conducted a stunning in-depth investigation of the SKS suicides and their supporting needs to be quoted at length to understand just how evil this program is. The article begins, quote, first, they were stripped of their utensils, furniture, mobile phones, televisions, ration cards, and heirloom gold jewelry. Then some of them drank pesticide. One woman threw herself into a pond. Another jumped into a well with her children. Sometimes the debt collectors watched nearby, unquote. What prompted the AP investigation was the gulf between the reported rash of suicides linked to SKS debt collectors and SKS's public statements denying it had knowledge of or any role in the predatory lending abuses. And skipping down. Then you might want to ask yourself why Omidyar is so smitten by the ideas of an economist known as the Friedrich Hayek of Latin America. His name is Hernando de Soto, and he's been adored by everyone from Milton Friedman to Margaret Thatcher to the Koch brothers. Omidyar Network poured millions of nonprofit dollars into subsidizing his ideas, helping put them into practice in poor slums around the developing world. And the aforementioned Hernando de Soto, was actually mentored by Friedrich Hayek, whom we have in the past, his last name is H-A-Y-E-K, may very well have been a Third Reich intelligence officer. He is one of the leading lights, so to speak, of the Austrian School of Economics that is embraced by Julian Assange, by Edward Snowden, and by an awful lot of people who really should probably know better. Time permitting, at the end of the program, we will refresh ourselves on just who Hernando de Soto is. However, that will depend on the amount of time that we have left. Suffice it to say that the efforts of Hernando de Soto and Pierre Omidyar, who just adores Hernando de Soto, are anything but charitable or philanthropic. In fact, they are as cynical and brutally destructive as anything could be. And one of the things to note is how the philanthropic efforts of the Omidyar Network and the political covert operations of Pierre Omidyar or Citizen Omidyar merge. And in turn, as we will see later on in the program, those have resulted in fascism in several parts of the world, in particular on the eastern flank of the Earth Island in Ukraine and on part of the southern flank of the Earth Island, where Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist slash fascist BJP, which is a cat's paw for the RSS, more about that later, that has come to power largely as a result of Pierre Omidyar's efforts. With regard to the above-mentioned SKS micro-lending scandal, we should also note that Pierre Omidyar's networks and the Omidyar Network and the Ford Foundation, a frequent vehicle for covert operations abroad and here in the U.S., were caught red-handed, basically, gaming the Indian political landscape for their own purposes. Once again, from the extraordinary Pierre Omidyar by Mark Ames and Yasha Levine from NSFW Corp of November 15th of 2013. Curiously, in the aftermath of the SKS micro-lending scandal, Omidyar Network was dragged into another political scandal in India when it was revealed that Omidyar and the Ford Foundation were placing their own paid researchers onto the staffs of India's MPs. The program, called Legislative Assistance to MPs, or LAMPs, was funded with $1 million from Omidyar Network and $855,000 from the Ford Foundation, again, a frequent vehicle for covert operations or the financing the same, both abroad and here in the U.S. Back to the discussion of the LAMPs. It was shut down last year after India's Ministry of Home Affairs complained about foreign lobbying influence buying Indian members of parliament and promised to investigate how Omidyar-funded research for India's parliament may have been, quote, colored, unquote, by an agenda. And that, again, is one of the areas in which we see political covert operations and philanthropy merging, and the results turning out to be utterly devastating. And we should note, too, that the recent ascension of Narendra Modi to being Prime Minister of India was accomplished in no small measure through the actions of the Omidyar Network, and in particular the guy named Jayant Sinha, I may be mispronouncing that, J-A-Y-A-N-T-S-I-N-H-A. He had been the director of the Omidyar Network's efforts in India, including the devastating SKS finance micro-lending program that I discussed. He then basically took time off to help manage Narendra Modi's successful election campaign. Modi is the standard bearer for a party called the BJP, that's Boy Jonathan Paul. That is basically the political cat's paw for an organization called the RSS. The Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, that is a Hindu nationalist slash fascist organization, one of whose members assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. And Nathuram Godse, that assassin, has been hailed by members of the RSS and the members of the BJP as a hero, unquote, although they've sort of backtracked in the typical fashion of someone who has gone over the top and jumped the shark and realized that they can't really come out and say what they truly believe. From an article called eBay Shrugged, Pierre Omidyar believes there should be no philanthropy without profit. This again by Mark Ames from the Pando Daily of May 31st of 2014. We find the following, skipping down. This week, India's newly elected ultra-nationalist leader Narendra Modi unveiled his cabinet, three-quarters of whom come from a fascist paramilitary outfit, the RSS, including one minister accused by police last year of inciting deadly Hindu-Muslim violence that left over 50 dead. The RSS was founded in 1925 by open admirers of Mussolini and Hitler. In 1948, an RSS member assassinated pacifist Mahatma Gandhi. In 1992, it was the RSS that organized the destruction of the Ayodhya Mosque, leaving 2,000 dead, mostly Muslims. And in 2002, the RSS played a key role in the mass murders of minority Muslims in Gujarat, according to Human Rights Watch, when the state of Gujarat was ruled by Narendra Modi, himself a product of the RSS. Earlier this week, Panda reported that Modi's election received help from unlikely sources in Silicon Valley, including Google, and to a much more serious extent, Omidyar Network, the philanthropy fund of eBay billionaire and First Look publisher Pierre Omidyar. Again, note that before we continue with this excerpt, note that 3/4 of Modi's cabinet comes from the fascist RSS, a Hindu nationalist and fascist organization. Continuing, from 2009 through February of this year, that year being 2014, Omidyar Network India Advisors was headed by Jayant Sinha, Jayant Sinha, a longtime Modi advisor and newly elected MP in Modi's ultra-nationalist BJP party ticket. The Omidyar Network partner and managing director played a double role, investing funds in Indian non-profits and for-profits, some with distinctly political agendas, while privately, the Omidyar man, quote, worked in Modi's team in 2012 and 13 and served as director in the ultra-nationalist BJP party's main think tank on security and economic policy, the India Foundation. This week, Modi appointed the head of the India Foundation, former intelligence chief Ajit Doval, A-J-I-T-D-O-V-A-L, as his national security advisor. And again, do note that this is a party that was brought to power in no small measure by the efforts of Pierre Omidyar and the director of his philanthropic efforts in India. Now, once again, we're going to dolly the camera out a little bit further, and while keeping our focus on the, quote, philanthropy, unquote, of Pierre Omidyar in India, we're going to take a look at some of the manifest economic ideology that has, that basically underlies Omidyar's efforts. Again, bear in mind that it is Citizen Omidyar, this Silicon Valley saint of truth, so to speak, who is underwriting the journalistic efforts of Citizen Greenwald and Laura Poitras and others. One of the central features for the Omidyar Network's philanthropic efforts in India is something called the Rural Development Institute, or IDI, later renamed Landesa, L-A-N-D-E-S-A. Now, this was founded by a guy named Roy Prosterman, P-R-O-S-T-E-R-M-A-N, and it served as a key element of the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Later, Prosterman put the same, quote, land reform program to work in El Salvador when thousands of Salvadorians were massacred by U.S.-trained government forces. And he has worked in other areas as well. And again, this is anything but philanthropy. What, again, we're looking at here is the synthesis of philanthropy, covert operation, and ultimately the elevation of fascism. And note that what the microfinance or micro-lending philanthropic efforts of Pierre Omidyar are aimed at doing is basically realizing a neoliberal agenda in the countries that are affected by these programs.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Once again, from eBay Shrugged, Pierre Omidyar believes there should be no philanthropy without profit. And these, by the way, are for-profit operations. Skipping down. India, like many developing countries around the world, has what Anglo-Americans consider a weak legal structure on property rights. In particular, local indigenous peoples lay ancient claims to lands they live on and have resisted state attempts to forcibly evict them to make way for industry, mining, and other powerful interests. The Naxal Maoist insurgencies raging in parts of India are fueled in part by displaced, landless peoples. Since Modi's election landslide, global investors have been hopeful that India's land will now be made easier to buy and sell. This is not all that far removed from some of the militia activity, basically working the Koch brothers' agenda in parts of the American West. Continuing, Omega Network's longtime top man in India, Jayant Sinha, now an MP in Modi's far-right ruling party, told CNBC that Modi's first job should be making land acquisition easier. "We have to start with land acquisition. We have to make land acquisition a lot better in terms of both the people that are acquiring the land from the farmers and so on, as well as for industry." So perhaps it's little surprise that Omidyar's first major India grant in 2008 went to the Rural Development Institute's renamed Landesa program, quote, "to help secure land rights for the rural poor in India's Andhra Pradesh state." By 2009, Omidyar Network had committed $9 million to the RDI Land Rights Program, the largest grant in the outfit's history. And what a history it is. The Rural Development Institute was founded in 1967 by Roy Prosterman, whose land reform programs were a key element in the Vietnam War counterinsurgency strategy, the Phoenix Assassination Program. The Phoenix Program became the template for modern American counterinsurgency, violent terror combined with soft power land reforms cooked up by Prosterman's Institute. During the Vietnam War, Prosterman teamed up with USAID to implement his Land to the Pillars reforms, granting land to peasants as the carrot, while at the same time, CIA death squads assassinated tens of thousands of Vietnamese village leaders and terrorized restive regions into submission. The result, Prosterman later boasted, was that Viet Cong recruitment dropped 80%. A decade later, Prosterman sold the same land reform program to El Salvador's junta, just as the junta was ramping up its deadly attacks on rural civilians that left 75,000 killed by U.S.-backed government forces. Prosterman also served as land reform, unquote, advisor to Philippines dictator Ferdinand Marcos. And in the 1990s, Prosterman was contracted by Booz Allen to advise land reforms in Moldova, according to journalist Tim Sharrock. And skipping down. A few years ago, Prosterman's Rural Development Institute changed its name to Landesa, L-A-N-D-E-S-A. But Prosterman's Cold War outfit hasn't changed its close cooperation with the U.S. Agency for International Development, parenthetically a cat's paw for U.S. intelligence, or its core strategic mission, tying land ownership to security and counterinsurgency, neatly summed up by Landesa's Indian Director's article, "Connecting the Dots Between Security and Land Rights in India," unquote. Leaving aside the alleged benefits to India's poor of giving them land title to the commons, 400 million Indians live on less than $1.25 a day. For the more powerful interests funding land titling programs, there are endless advantages. And here, basically, is the neoliberal free market corporatist agenda that is realized in part through the, quote, philanthropic, unquote, efforts of citizen Omidyar and the covert action that is part and parcel and inextricably linked with that, quote, philanthropy. Returning to that article. It helps to create a mass tax base for governments that want to shift more taxes onto the masses. It formalizes and legalizes transfer of property from the commons to the strongest and richest. It makes foreign investors happy. It helps the government of businesses track and keep data on its citizens. And to quote Omidyar Network Managing Partner Matt Bannick, B-A-N-N-I-C-K, Prosterman's land reforms made Omidyar, quote, excited about how micro-land ownership can empower women and help them to pull themselves out of poverty. Doesn't that sound wonderful? I mean, it's just, I'm just brimming over with excitement at the wonderful possibilities of that, obviously. I'm being extremely sarcastic. And again, remember the person we're looking at here, Pierre Omidyar, is the journalistic/financial angel who has benefited Citizen Greenwald and Laura Poitras and others of the Snowdenistas. To give you an idea of what the, quote, philanthropy, unquote, that Citizen Omidyar has been doing, and again, it is the former director of Omidyar Networks in India, Jayant Sinha, took time off to help manage Modi's campaign, and then became a member of parliament in Modi's BJP party afterward. We're going to review some information. Again, Modi's BJP is a cat's paw for the RSS, one of whose members assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. That was founded in 1925 by open admirers of Hitler and Mussolini. Three quarters of Modi's cabinet comes from the RSS. He was a member of that. Now, when you take elements like that and put them in power, this is what you get. From the court's blog of May 4th of 2015, article by Rashme, R-A-S-H-M-E, Sehgal, S-E-H-G-A-L. I'm probably mispronouncing many of these Indian names. The Modi government is sending millions of kids back into exploitative labor. An amendment to the Child Labor Prohibition Act proposed by the Narendra Modi-led government is about to undo years of hard-won progress in the area of child labor and condemn millions of kids to exploitative employment. The amendment will allow children below the age of 14 to work in family enterprises, unquote, a euphemism for industries such as carpet weaving, BD rolling, BEE, BWDI, gem polishing, lock making, and matchbox making. The new norms will also apply to the entertainment industry and sports. The amendment flies in the face of the Right to Education Act of 2009, which guarantees education to every child. After the RTE came in, child labor dropped from 12.6 million in 2001 to 4.3 million in 2014. That's by more than two-thirds. Continuing, the amendment will undo much of that progress. It will also be a serious setback to all the work done by activists such as Swami Agnivesh, A-G-N-I-V-E-S-H, and Nobel laureate Kailash Satyarthi, S-A-T-Y-A-R-T-H-I, to rescue children from bonded labor and exploitation. Mirzapur-based Shamshad Khan, president of the Center for Rural Education and Development Action, calls the move retrogressive, unquote. All our campaigns to end bonded child labor starting from the 80s will go up in smoke, unquote, Khan said. Again, quoting, schools will be emptied out and poor children in states like Bihar, Jharkhand, and Uttar Pradesh will be back to working in sheds and makeshift factories that will all go by the nomenclature of family enterprises, unquote. The worst hit will be the children of the Dalits, that those are the, quote, untouchables, unquote, Muslims, tribal families, and those belonging to marginalized communities, unquote. The amendment can also be used to deny education to the girl child who will be sucked into all forms of housework. According to government statistics, beginning again, according to government statistics, male literacy levels in 2014 stood at 82%, while female literacy levels were as low as 64%. The school dropout rate for girls is almost double the rate for boys. An unconstitutional change, Bandaru Dattatreya, India's Minister of Labor and Employment, announced in early April that the government planned to introduce amendments to the Child Labor Prohibition Act in the current session of Parliament. His ministry, while seeking the amendments, said the act will not apply to children helping families in home-based work, and especially families working in agriculture and animal rearing. The objective of these amendments, according to ministry officials, is to help children nurture a spirit of entrepreneurship. They will particularly help children of families currently living at subsistence levels, the ministry claims. Child rights activists say the move will benefit factory owners in India's cow belt. Their profits will escalate fourfold as children could be made to work longer hours and paid much less than adults. And basically, it is being hailed accurately, apparently, as a return to the bad old days. And not only is India seeing child labor brought back, but free speech is being disintegrated as well. New York Times, October 2nd of 2015, India's attack on free speech by Sonia Faliero, F-A-L-E-I-R-O, from the New York Times. In today's India, secular liberals face a challenge. How to stay alive. In August, 77-year-old scholar M.M. Kalburgi, an outspoken critic of Hindu idol worship, was gunned down on his own doorstep. In February, the communist leader Govind Pansori was killed near Mumbai. And in 2013, the activist Narendra Dabholkar was murdered for campaigning against religious superstitions. These killings should be seen as the canary in the coal mine. Secular voices are being censored, and others will follow. While there have always been episodic attacks on free speech in India, this one feels different. The harassment is front-page news, but the government refuses to acknowledge it. Indeed, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's silence is being interpreted by many people as tacit approval, given that the attacks have gained momentum since he took office in 2014 and are linked to Hindutva groups whose far-right ideology he shares. Hindutva, H-I-N-D-U-T-V-A. And this article, in fact, all of these articles are in almost their entirety in the written description for the record 889, which will be available later today, today being February 11th of 2016. Now, note that Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist slash fascist party has an overt anti-Muslim agenda. And indeed, there have been mob vigilante acts of violence against Muslims in India, allegedly for killing cows. And cows are sacred to the Hindus. An article about that in the New York Times of October 5th of 2015. India politics are backdrop in mob attack by David Barstow, B-A-R-S-T-O-W, and Suhasini Raj, R-A-J is his last name. And skipping down, we're reading about the killing of a man named Mohammed Ikhlaq, I-K-H-L-A-Q. Mr. Ikhlaq and his wife, Ikraman, I-K-R-A-M-A-N, were on their second-floor patio dozing after dinner and prayers. Suddenly their home was swarming with men. Mr. Ikhlaq heard someone shout, "Kill them!" She and her husband and their son, Dinesh, 20, retreated inside behind a thick wooden door. The mob shattered the door. "What's the matter?" Mrs. Ikhlaq cried out. An incredulous voice replied from the dark, "After slaughtering a cow, you are asking us what's the matter?" Men began to paw at Mrs. Ikhlaq as she bit hard into a sweaty hand, broke free and fled downstairs, too scared to even breathe, she said in an interview. Upstairs, the mob bludgeoned her husband with her sewing machine and smashed her son's head with a brick. Then they dragged Mr. Ikhlaq down 14 cement steps and out to the main road by the transformer, where he was left for all to see.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
And that basically is the sad truths behind the violence against people in India, and that the full discussion there is illuminative of just how the Modi government has been a part and parcel to what has been going on in India. And again, one should note that the violence, the Save the Cows movement in India is inextricably linked with Modi's BJP. And again, these articles in their entirety are in the written description for the Record 889, which will be published later today, February 11th of 2016. Due to the limitations of time, we're going to continue with our analysis of Pierre Omidyar's, or Citizen Omidyar's, activities around the world. Now, one of the things that we have noted, again, Pierre Omidyar has worked with cutouts for U.S. intelligence, such as the Agency for International Development and the National Endowment for Democracy and others. And those basically, again, have been cutouts for U.S. intelligence. And we should not lose sight of not only who he was, where he is working with, but the activities that he has been engaged in as a result. Talking about Pierre Omidyar's funding of the Maidan revolution in Ukraine, another article by Mark Ames from the Pando Daily of February 28th of 2014. Pierre Omidyar co-funded Ukraine revolution groups with U.S. government, documents show. And what Pierre Omidyar did was to, again, help to finance the Maidan revolution. And one of the key people involved with Omidyar's efforts in Ukraine was a guy named Oleh, O-L-E-H, Rybachuk, R-Y-B-A-C-H-U-K. He became a key cabinet member under Viktor Yushchenko, whose organization saw the first major penetration of the OUNB heirs into Ukraine. And Rybachuk was charged with helping to coordinate the activities of Ukraine with those of NATO. Turning now to an excerpt from that article. In 1992, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Rybachuk moved to the newly formed Ukraine Central Bank, heading the Foreign Relations Department under Central Bank Chief and future Orange Revolution leader Viktor Yushchenko. In his Central Bank post, Rybachuk established close, friendly ties with Western government and financial aid institutions, as well as proto-Omidyar figures like George Soros, who funded many of the NGOs involved in color revolutions, including small donations to the same Ukraine NGOs that Omidyar backed. Skipping down. In early 2005, Orange Revolution leader Yushchenko became Ukraine's president, and he appointed Rybachuk deputy prime minister in charge of integrating Ukraine into the EU, NATO, and other Western institutions. Rybachuk also pushed for the mass privatization of Ukraine's remaining state holdings. Over the next several years, Rybachuk was shifted around President Yushchenko's embattled administration, torn by internal divisions. In 2010, Yushchenko lost the presidency to recently overthrown Viktor Yanukovych, and a year later, Rybachuk was on Omidyar's and USAID's payroll preparing for the next Orange Revolution. As Rybachuk told the Financial Times 2 years ago, "We want to do the Orange Revolution again, and we think we will." Note that Viktor Yushchenko's first lady was the former Ekaterina Shumachenko, who had been deputy director of public liaison under Ronald Reagan and a member of the key OUNB front organization in the U.S., the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. We've done a lot of programs about the return to power of the OUNB heirs in Ukraine, and the information about the Orange Revolution, or what I termed in For the Record 885 Maidan 1, and its links with elements going back to the Reagan administration and forward to the Maidan 2 of the late winter of 2014, are discussed in many programs. Now again, note that the role being played by Oleh Rybachuk, basically helping to integrate Ukraine into the EU and NATO and other Western institutions, has since been taken up after Maidan 2, financed in part by Pierre Omidyar. And again, the article, Pierre Omidyar co-funded Ukraine revolution groups with U.S. government documents show, and one of the people who is playing a key role in the Poroshenko government and basically fulfilling the same type of agenda that Oleh Rybachuk fulfilled under Viktor Yushchenko, the Orange Revolution being Maidan 1 in effect, is a woman named Svetlana Zalishuk, Zalischuk. Another Mark Ames story from the Pando Daily, this from October 30th of 2014, Omidyar funded candidate takes seat in new Ukraine parliament, and it reads in part as follows, skipping down. Zalishuk was given a choice spot on the president's party list at number 18, ensuring her a seat in the new Rada or Ukrainian parliament. And she owes her rise to power to another oligarch besides Ukraine's president, Pierre Omidyar, whose funding with the U.S. Agency for International Development helped topple the previous government. Zalishuk's pro-Maidan revolution outfits were directly funded by Omidyar. Zalishuk has been deeply involved in pushing for the lustration laws, which are highly undemocratic, and note here that she has been networking with the various neo-fascist parties in Ukraine and helping to coordinate activities between them and the so-called moderates in Ukraine. Continuing with this article, earlier this year, Pando explored how eBay billionaire and Intercept publisher Pierre Omidyar co-funded with USAID Zalishuk's web of non-governmental organizations, New Citizen Chesno Center UA. According to the Financial Times, New Citizen, which received hundreds of thousands of dollars from Omidyar, quote, played a big role in getting the Maidan protest up and running in November of 2013. Omidyar Network's website features Zalishuk's photograph on its page describing its investments in New Citizen. Zalishuk was brought into the NGOs by her longtime mentor, Oleh Rybachuk, a former deputy prime minister who led the last failed effort to integrate Ukraine into the EU and NATO, and also a main beneficiary of Omidyar's efforts. Continuing, skipping down. The president's party tasked Zalishuk with publicly selling the highly controversial new lustration law, essentially a legalized witch hunt law first proposed by the neo-fascist Svoboda Party earlier this year and subsequently denounced by Ukraine's prosecutor general and by Human Rights Watch, which described a draft of the law as arbitrary and overly broad and fails to respect human rights principles, warning, quote, it may set the stage for unlawful mass arbitrary political exclusion. The lustration law was passed under a wave of neo-Nazi violence in which members of parliament and others set to be targeted for purges were forcibly thrown into trash dumps. Zalishuk, however, praised the lustration laws, claiming that the legalized purges would, quote, give Ukraine a chance at a new life. Shortly before the election on October 17th, Zalishuk used her Omidyar-funded outfit Chesno to organize a roundtable with leaders of pro-EU and neo-fascist parties. It was called Parliament for Reform, and it brought together leaders from 8 parties, including Zalishuk's Poroshenko bloc. She served as both NGO organizer and as pro-Poroshenko party candidate, the Prime Minister's People's Party, and leaders from 2 unabashedly Nazi parties, Svoboda and the Radical Party of Oleh Ryashko. And note again, she has worked with Oleh Rybachuk, who was a member of Viktor Yushchenko's cabinet under the Orange Revolution. Also, like Svetlana Zaleshchuk, was an Omidyar protege and working to integrate Ukraine with NATO and the EU. We're going to wind up by taking a look at Pierre Omidyar's formal partnering with an organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which again is basically a cutout for elements of U.S. intelligence. And we're going to take a look at an article again by Mark Ames, again from the Pando Daily. This from July 31st of last year, 2015. What Pierre did next. And this is what he did next, skipping down. The Guardian reported on Tuesday that the National Endowment for Democracy has just been banned from Russia under strict new laws regarding NGOs acting as foreign agents. In that story, the Guardian cited the fact that Intercept publisher Pierre Omidyar co-funded Ukraine Revolution groups with USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy, or NED. If the Omidyar connection sounds familiar, that's because it was Pando that first broke the story in February of 2014. In the 18 months since we broke the story, Ukraine has collapsed into war and despair, with up to 10,000 people killed and 1.5 million internally displaced refugees, and top U.S. brass talk openly of a new Cold War with nuclear-armed Russia, while U.S. military advisors train and arm Ukrainians to wage war on Russian-backed separatists. Svetlana Zaleshchuk, one of the leaders of the Omidyar-funded NGO that helped organize last year's revolution in Kiev, is now in power as an MP in Ukraine's parliament and a member of the new pro-NATO President's Party bloc. And talking about Omidyar and NED, once again, talking about Svetlana Zaleshchuk, she's gone from plucky Omidyar-funded adversarial activist to heading a parliamentary subcommittee tasked with integrating Ukraine into NATO. I can't think of another media tycoon who co-founded a pro-U.S. regime with American intelligence cutouts like USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy. Skipping down. Speaking of the NED, one of the NED's co-founders, Alan Weinstein, explained its purpose to the Washington Post. A lot of what we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA. The NED was the brainchild of Reagan's CIA director, William Casey, and it was specifically set up, as explained in the story, as a cutout for U.S. intelligence. Continuing with this excerpt, this week Omidyar Network announced yet another partnership with the National Endowment for Democracy and the Poynter Institute to create an international online fact-checking hub. Given the power that a monopoly on, quote, objective, unquote, fact-checking offers, the tie-up with the NED takes the Omidyar alliance with the U.S. empire and media to newer, creepier levels. In yet another Omidyar as private arm investment, Omidyar invested in the slick new Ukrainian media Romadsky TV, which was set up on the eve of the Maidan Revolution with initial seed funding from the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. Omidyar's involvement in Ukraine media and fact-checking is all the more serious given the new Washington and NATO talk about countering, unquote, Russia's overhyped information war, unquote, on the West and on Ukraine. I don't think it's that much of a reach seeing once again a quote fact-checking service being set up by Pierre Omidyar and NED. I don't think it is too much of a reach to see The Intercept and the other First Look media efforts being bankrolled by Pierre Omidyar as something of an information war here in the U.S. And again, it is Citizen Omidyar who has bankrolled the journalistic efforts of Citizen Greenwald. This concludes For the Record program number 889, Intercept This, Compendium on Citizen Omidyar. This is being recorded on February 11th of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.